Chapter 15. A staffer from the Office of Protection Research was waiting when Reacher and Nagley and Stuyvesant got back to the Treasury building. He was standing in the reception area wearing a knitted sweater and blue pants, like he had run straight in from the family dinner table. He was about Reacher's age and looked like a university professor except for his eyes. They were wise and wary, like he had seen a few things and heard about plenty more. His name was Swain. Stuyvesant introduced him all around and disappeared. Swain led Reacher and Nagley through corridors they hadn't used before to an area that clearly doubled as a library and a lecture room. It had a dozen chairs set facing a podium and was lined on three walls with bookshelves. The fourth wall had a row of hutches with computers on desks, a printer next to each computer.
"I heard what the FBI is saying," Swain said.
"You believe it?" Reacher asked. Swain just shrugged. "Yes and no," Reacher asked.
"I guess it's not impossible," Swain said. "But there's no reason to believe it's likely.
Just as likely that it's ex-FBI agents, or current FBI agents. As an agency, we're better than they are. Maybe they're trying to bring us down. Think we should look in that direction?"
"You're Joe Reacher's brother, aren't you?"
Reacher nodded.
"I worked with him," Swain said, "way back."
"And?"
"He used to encourage random observations."
"So do I," Reacher said. "You got any?"
"My job is strictly academic. You understand, I'm purely a researcher. A scholar, really. I'm here to analyze."
"And?"
"This situation feels different from anything else I've seen. The hatred is very visible. Assassinations fall into two groups, ideological or functional. A functional assassination is where you need to get rid of a guy for some specific political or economic reason. An ideological assassination is where you murder a guy because you hate him, basically. There have been plenty of attempts along those lines over the years. I can't tell you about any of them except to say that most don't get very far, and that there's certainly always plenty of hatred involved. But usually it's well hidden down at the conspirator level. They whisper among themselves. All we ever see is the results. But this time the hatred is right there in our face. They've gone to a lot of trouble and taken a lot of risks to make sure we know all about it."
"So what's your conclusion?"
"I just think the early phase was extraordinary. The messages? Think about the risks. Think about the energy required to minimize those risks. They put unbelievable resources into the early phase, so I have to assume they felt it was worthwhile."
"But it wasn't," Nagley said. "Armstrong has never seen any of the messages. They were wasting their time."
"Simple ignorance," Swain said. "Were you aware we absolutely won't discuss threats with a protectee?"
"No," Nagley said. "I was surprised."
"Nobody's aware," Swain said.
"Everybody's surprised. These guys thought they were getting right to him. So I'm convinced it's personal, aimed at him, not us."
"So are we," Reacher said. "You got a specific reason?"
"You think I'm naive, but I don't believe anybody who works or has worked for us would have killed the other two Armstrongs. Not just like that."
Reacher shrugged. "Maybe you're naive, maybe you aren't. But it doesn't matter, we're convinced anyway."
"What's your reason?"
"The hyphen in the second message."
"The hyphen?"
Swain said. Then he paused.
"Yes. I see, plausible, but a little circumstantial, wouldn't you say?"
"Whatever, we're working with the assumption it was personal."
"Okay, but why? Only possible answer is they absolutely hate him. They wanted to taunt him, scare him, make him suffer first. Just shooting him isn't enough for them."
"So who are they?
Who hates him that bad?"
Swain made a gesture with his hand like he was pushing that question aside.
"Something else. This is a little off the wall, but I think we're miscounting. How many messages have there been?"
"Six," Reacher said.
"No," Swain said. "I think there have been seven."
"Where's the seventh?"
"Nendick," Swain said. "I think Nendick delivered the second message and was the third message. You see, you got here, and 48 hours later you got to Nendick, which was pretty quick. But with respect, we'd have gotten there anyway, sooner or later. It was inevitable. If it wasn't the cleaners, it had to be the tape, so we'd have gotten there. And what was waiting for us? Nendick wasn't just a delivery system. He was a message in himself. He showed what these people are capable of. Assuming Armstrong was in the loop, he'd have been getting pretty shaky by that point."
Then there are 9 messages, Nagley said. On that basis, we should add in the Minnesota and the Colorado situations.
Absolutely, Swain said.
You see what I mean? Everything has fear, has its purpose. Every single thing. Suppose Armstrong was in the loop all along. He gets the first message. He's worried. We get the second message. He's more worried. We trace its source and he starts to feel better, but no. It gets even worse because we find Nendick paralyzed with fear. Then we get the demonstration threat. He's worried some more. Then the demonstration happens and he's devastated by how ruthless it was.
Reacher said nothing, just stared at the floor.
You think I'm overanalytical, Swain said.
Reacher shook his head, still looking at the floor.
No, I think I'm under-analytical, maybe.
Possibly.
Because what are the thumbprints about?
They're a taunt of a different sort. They're a boast, a puzzle, a tease, can't catch me sort of thing.
How long did you work with my brother?
5 years.
I worked for him, really. I say with him is a vain attempt at status.
Was he a good boss?
He was a great boss. Great guy all around.
And he ran random observation sessions?
Swain nodded. They were fun. Anybody could say anything.
Did he join in?
He was very lateral.
Reacher looked up.
You just said everything has fear as its purpose, every single thing. Then you said the thumbprints are a taunt of a different sort. So, not everything is the same, right? Something's different.
Swain shrugged.
I could stretch it. The thumbprints induce the fear that these guys are too clever to be caught. Different sort of fear, but it's still fear.
Reacher looked away, went quiet. 30 seconds, a whole minute.
I'm going to cave in, he said.
Finally. I'm going to be like Joe. I'm wearing his suit. I was sleeping with his girlfriend. I keep meeting his old colleagues. So now I'm going to make a lateral, random, off-the-wall observation, just like he did, apparently.
What is it? Nagley said.
I think we missed something, Reacher said. Just skated right on by it.
What?
I've got all these weird images going around in my head. Like, for instance, Stuyvesant's secretary doing things at her desk.
What things?
I think we've got the thumbprint exactly ass backward. All along, we've assumed they knew it was untraceable, but I think we're completely wrong. I think it's just the opposite. I think they expected it would be traceable.
Why?
Because I think the thumbprint thing is exactly the same as the Nendick thing. I met a watchmaker today. He told me where squalene comes from.
Shark's livers, Nagley said.
And people's noses, Reacher said. Same stuff. That gunk you wake up with in the morning is squalene. Same chemical, exactly.
So?
So, I think our guys gambled and got unlucky. Suppose you picked a random male person aged about 60 or 70. What are the chances he'd have been fingerprinted at least once in his lifetime?
Pretty good, I guess, Nagley said. All immigrants are printed. American-born? He'd have been drafted for Korea or Vietnam and printed even if he didn't go. He'd have been printed if he'd ever been arrested or worked for the government.
Or for some private corporations, Swain said. Plenty of them require prints. Banks, retailers, people like that.
Okay, Reacher said. So here's the thing. I don't think the thumbprint comes from one of the guys themselves. I think it comes from somebody else entirely. From some innocent bystander. From somebody they picked out at random. And it was supposed to lead us directly to that somebody.
The room went quiet. Nagley stared at Reacher.
What for?
She asked. So we could find another Nendick. The thumbprint was on every message, and the guy it came from was a message, just like Swain says Nendick was. We were supposed to trace the print and find the guy and find an exact replica of the Nendick situation. Some terrified victim, too scared to open his mouth and tell us anything. A message in himself. But by pure accident, our guys hit on somebody who had never been printed, so we couldn't find him.
But there were 6 paper messages, Swain said. Probably 20 days between the first one going in the mail and the last one being delivered to Froelich's house, so what does that mean? All the messages were prepared in advance?
That's way too much planning ahead, surely.
It's possible, Nagley said. They could have printed dozens of variations, one for every eventuality.
No, Reacher said. I think they printed them up as they went along. I think they kept the thumbprint available to them at all times.
How?
Swain asked.
They abducted some guy and took him hostage? They've stashed him somewhere? They're taking him everywhere with them?
Couldn't work, Nagley said. Can't expect us to find him if he's not home.
He's home, Reacher said. But his thumb isn't.
Nobody spoke. Fire up a computer, Reacher said. Search NCIC for the word thumb.
We've got a big field office in Sacramento, Bannon said. Three agents are already mobile. A doctor, too. We'll know in an hour.
This time Bannon had come to them. They were in the Secret Service conference room, Stuyvesant at the head of the table, Reacher and Nagley and Swain together on one side, Bannon alone on the other.
It's a bizarre idea, Bannon said. What would they do? Keep it in the freezer?
Probably, Reacher said. Thaw it a bit, rub it down their nose, print it on the paper. Just like Stuyvesant's secretary with her rubber stamp. It's probably drying out a bit with age, which is why the squalene percentage keeps getting higher.
What are the implications, Stuyvesant said, assuming you're right.
Reacher made a face. We can change one major assumption. Now I would guess they both got prints on file, and they've both been wearing the latex gloves.
Two renegades, Bannon said.
Not necessarily ours, Stuyvesant said.
So explain the other factors, Bannon said.
Nobody spoke. Bannon shrugged.
Come on, he said. We've got an hour, and I don't want to be looking in the wrong place, so convince me. Show me these are private citizens gunning for Armstrong personally.
Stuyvesant glanced at Swain, but Swain said nothing.
Time is ticking by, Bannon said. This isn't an ideal context, Swain said.
Bannon smiled.
What? You only preach to the choir?
Nobody spoke.
You've got no case, Bannon said. I mean, who cares about a vice president? They're nobodies.
What was it? A bucket of warm spit?
It was a pitcher, Swain said. John Nance Garner said the vice presidency isn't worth a pitcher of warm spit. He also called it a spare tire on the automobile of government. He was FDR's first running mate. John Adams called it the most insignificant office man had ever invented, and he was the first vice president of all.
So who cares enough to shoot a spare tire or an insignificant pitcher of spit?
Let me start from the beginning, Swain said. What does a vice president do?
He sits around, Bannon says. Hopes the big guy dies.
Swain nodded. Somebody else said the vice president's job is merely about waiting. In case the president dies, sure, but more often for the nomination in his own right 8 years down the track. But in the short term, what is the vice president for?
Beats the hell out of me, Bannon said.
He's there to be a candidate, Swain said. That's the bottom line. His design life lasts from when he's tapped in the summer until election day. He's useful for 4 or 5 months, tops. He starts out as a pick-me-up for the campaign. Everybody's bored to death with the presidential nominees by midsummer, so the VP picks put a jolt into the campaigns. Suddenly, we've all got something else to talk about, somebody else to analyze. We look at their qualities and their records. We figure out how well they balance the tickets. That's their initial function, balance and contrast. Whatever the presidential nominee isn't, the VP nominee is, and vice versa. Young, old, racy, dull, northern, southern, dumb, smart, hard, soft, rich, poor.
We get the picture, Bannon said.
So he's there for what he is, Swain said. Initially, he's just a photograph and a biography. He's a concept. Then his duties start. He's got to have campaigning skills, obviously, because he's there to be the attack dog. He's got to be able to say the stuff the presidential candidate isn't allowed to say himself. If the campaign scripts an attack or a put-down, it's the VP candidate that get to deliver it. Meanwhile, the presidential candidate stands around somewhere else looking all statesmanlike. Then the election happens and the presidential candidate goes to the White House and the VP gets put away in a closet. His usefulness is over first Tuesday in November.
Was Armstrong good at that kind of stuff?
He was excellent. The truth is, he was a very negative campaigner. But the polls didn't really show it because he kept that nice smile on his face the whole time. Truth is, he was deadly. And you think he trod on enough toes to get himself assassinated for it?